Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the call by Russia's President Putin to discuss statehood for eastern Ukraine and go to Moscow to speak with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, an independent defense analyst who writes for Novaya Gazeta, practically the only newspaper left in Russia not controlled by the Kremlin. We will discuss Putin's strategy of permanent destabilization of Ukraine until it submits to Moscow's demands and the much less likely scenario of a Russian military invasion to carve out a land corridor to Crimea. Then we will speak with Laurie Wallach, the founder and director of Global Trade Watch at Public Citizen, who is an expert on NAFTA, the WTO, CAFTA, and the latest trade agreement now in the works, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We will discuss why it is that President Obama, who can't get anything done with the current Congress, has been given fast-track authority by Congress to negotiate the TPP in secret, in spite of a continuing trickle of leaks coming from the negotiations between the United States and Canada, Mexico, Peru, Chile, New Zealand, Brunei, Singapore, Malaysia, Vietnam, Australia, and Japan. Then finally, on this Labor Day weekend, we will examine the state of working America with Silvio Allegretto, a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley, and the co-author of several editions of The State of Working America, a biannual report that is considered the authoritative source on the American workforce. We will discuss how the median salary for a male worker in 1969 was $35,567 in 2012 dollars, and today it is $33,904, indicating that for 44 years most Americans have been caught in a great stagnation, while the wages of the top 10% have continued to climb. And joining us now from Moscow is Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who's a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and from 1994 to 2005 published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Dr. Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer.
Hello.
And President Putin has gone on television and calling for talks to discuss statehood for eastern Ukraine. And that seems to be combined with military activity. Is he opening a front in the southeast and perhaps even a land corridor into Crimea?
Well, most likely not yet. Right now, what Putin has been saying and what the Russian military and his orders, of course, have been doing is more or less consistent with the Russian position, Putin's position for several months already on the rebellion in the so-called Nova Russia part. South and east part of Ukraine. It's not apparently understood in Kyiv fully, at least in time, or maybe in the West, everyone, that Russia would never, ever allow a military defeat by the rebels. And Putin is ready to do what it takes to prevent such a total defeat and the destruction of this kind of Nova Russia rebellion in Ukraine. And so the tactical successes and advances by the Ukrainian military in recent weeks, I mean, the more effective and they were the worst, actually. The situation became strategically. Russia was increasing the flow of men, volunteers, and arms over the border in an attempt to balance the military situation. And when that didn't help, actually, Russian regular troops apparently went over the border and hit hard the Ukrainian forces, which made a rather stupid mistake of moving out to the Russian border area, trying to kind of surround the rebels and cut them off from supplies in Russia. Most likely believing in that, what Ukrainian officials now say, that Russia would never actually go directly into action, I mean, against the UN Charter and other things like that. Well, I mean, they were mistaken. Russia did go. But right now it seems this the move was sort of limited in scope. I mean, we're talking about thousands of Russian troops apparently operating in Ukraine, but not tens of thousands. And Russian Air Force has not been actually deployed. And it also seems that after the initial Russian move, and then the kind of defeated, surrounded some parts, some formations of the Ukrainian armed forces. Now there's these formations, some of them are capitulating, and the soldiers are being allowed to leave the border area without weapons. But it seems the Russian troops are not given orders to move actually decisively out of the border area further into Ukraine. And so the situation is, again, to some extent, stalled. So, since there were casualties which were not very taken well by the Russian public, and in general, this is not Putin's strategic objective, to just simply defeat Ukraine. Russia could have done that some time ago. Russia is much more stronger militarily than Ukraine. And actually, in April, when Russian troops seemed to be moving into Ukraine, in the end of April, and the Russian defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, said, we're kind of moving, and then they didn't move. Then most likely it would have been a much more easier to walk over for the Russian forces. They could have just simply swept the Ukrainian military, which were in a very bad state, under the carpet. But Putin didn't seem to give the last order, and we didn't go. Putin's objective and what he's talking about, having substantial discussions on statehood. And his press secretary, Peskov, explained that this is not that he's calling for independent recognition of independence immediate of this rebellious Novorossiya, but talks about what's going to have to be there and so on. And that's really consistent, because Putin's objective is not to sort of take over another part of Ukraine and leave the rest of Ukraine very angry and moving towards NATO. Putin's objective is to keep all of Ukraine out of the West and in the Russian sphere of influence. So he does not want an independent Novorossiya. He wants Novorossiya as part, as a rebellious part of Ukraine, but kind of a permanent rebellious part with an unclear state. I mean, it's going to anchor Ukraine inside the Russian sphere of influence, Ukraine having part of it under Russian de facto control and influence, could not move towards the West. This could be used as a leverage. So he wants to put a kind of shackles on Ukrainian feet and not just simply cut off a piece of Ukraine and forget about the rest.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who's a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist who previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and he is now a defense analyst on the staff of Novaya Gazeta. And, of course, Novaya Gazeta is about the only newspaper left in Russia that Putin doesn't control, and he's got complete control over the Russian media and over the Russian narrative about what is happening. My understanding is that a poll was done in Russia recently that found only 3% of people in Russia believe that the Malaysian airliner was shot down by pro-Russian rebels using a Russian missile. So he can keep this up for a long time, and that's his strategy. And what's your sense then, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, what could Kiev agree to? If Putin wants perpetual war to destabilize Ukraine, what is it that they could agree to? In other words, what could the West and Kiev agree to that would stop what's happening?
Well, I mean, in today's interview, Putin was talking, rather praised the present Ukrainian president and said that Petro Poroshenko, and said that he can make business with him. But he says that most likely right now it's not yet time, that there needs to be more time, that they can't take the right decisions yet, and that the crisis will continue to drag on, most likely maybe not perpetually, but a kind of frozen conflict. That's what Putin most likely envisages, to put Ukraine on a short leash and have a government there that's going to be dependent on him, dependent on Russian will and what happens within the rebellious areas. And that's what actually it's all the Putin's game is about. So the Ukrainians should either agree with that and take Russian terms, and that means forget about going west and actually having a more modern pro-Western country, or they have to brace themselves for a long conflict. It won't be easy, or it won't be soon to stop it. There can be, and maybe will be, ceasefires. Right now, the autumn is coming, and winter is coming in Russia and Ukraine. And in the autumn time, the weather is very lousy, and the possibility of military action is limited, especially in offensive, large-scale military action, because it's called Rasputitsa, the bad Russian weather. I mean, the fields become unpassable, even for tanks, just fighting on the limited number of roads is, well, it's not, you can't really maneuver there easily. So in those parts, you don't fight in the autumn. And in the autumn, you wait till either winter comes and everything freezes up, and you can move again through fields which are frozen and covered by snow and ice. Or again, you wait for summer. So an so-called operational pause is inevitable somewhere in October, most likely,
but is it
no matter what happens. That means there's going to be some kind of let-up in the fighting. And actually, that's most likely what Putin means. He said, ceasefire talks. He wants to freeze the situation as it is before it gets worse. His and many other Russian, in the Russian elite, in the Kremlin, their main nightmare is Western German tanks again in Kharkiv, aimed at Kursk and Moscow. I mean, like in 42 or 43, that NATO moves in, the Americans move in, the Germans move in with force, armed force. Just to the Moscow doorstep. And preventing that from happening is a must. And the present regime in Moscow will never stop to oppose and do anything it takes to prevent that.
But Pavel Felgenhauer, that is a fantasy. NATO is a fiction. It's a paper tiger. There are no American tanks in Germany. Does Putin really believe that NATO is preparing to invade, or is he just using that as propaganda?
No, that's very much believed. That's what the Russian general staff, I mean, the brain of our military says, but they'll move in. Of course, for them, having NATO as an enemy is very good for the Russian professional military. First of all, it's traditional. They've been an enemy since the Cold War, and those who are still right now in command of Russian military and military planning and military intelligence are people who began serving during the Cold War. And this is an enemy that never attacks, but poses a kind of bogus enemy that helps to get very fat defense budgets. So, of course, they're saying that in full earnest. This is a threat that's coming on, and we have to increase our defense spending, and we have to boost our forces because NATO is coming. And they want to go into Ukraine, and from Ukraine, it will be a stopover before they'll be surrounding Moscow. Yes, that's a thing that most people in the Russian ruling elite fully believe in. And, of course, the military officials say so. I mean, if you don't agree with it, you're an American spy.
Well, hasn't Putin, though, miscalculated with the Ukrainian people in the East? They don't really support this pro-Russian proxy of his, do they? Has he miscalculated? Does he recognize that the Ukrainian people and the Russian people have never, as far as I know, really hated each other? But isn't there some real hatred being generated by this war?
Well, yes, and even more so by a very vicious propaganda campaign in the Russian TV, which maybe has even overdone its job, because, latest polls show that support of invasion of Ukraine has fallen twofold from May to August, because Russian people became real, which were being fed stories, some exaggerated stories about ferocious war and massive destruction and casualties in Donbass, now are kind of afraid of war in general and don't want Russia to get involved in that terrible bloodshed that's happening there between Ukraine, which maybe could be a problem for the Kremlin. So right now, I would believe that that's one of the reasons why we just moved over the border, but they're not, say, right now marching on Mariupol or to build that land corridor to Crimea, because further engagement and losses would be seen in very bad light by the large part of the Russian population, which really does not want a war.
Do the Russian people know that there have been casualties? There was a Russian politician who was beaten up in Pskov, Lev Schlossberg, with the Obloko party. He's a publisher of a local newspaper that tried to report on what was happening, and he was beaten up. Given Putin's control of the media, are the Russian people learning about casualties of Russian soldiers who've died in Ukraine?
Well, there's a Soviet-style attempt to kind of make this very secret and make this a secret war with secret casualties and deny any kind of Russian direct involvement in the fighting whatsoever. But this is not, of course, a Soviet country anymore. There's much more there. There's internet kind of information coming in. The propaganda machine is effective, but it does not cover the entire population. And it's so I think many people know about that and are not very happy with it. And if there's going to be more fighting, because if we want to really take over large chunks of Ukraine and want to build this land corridor, we'd have to go in with much more force, more casualties, and we'd actually have to go in with air support, because a short attack in a series of attacks in the immediate border area, the Russian troops had a serious advantage of surprise, of firepower, and actually we could use firepower artillery and long-range artillery and multiple rocket launchers that were shooting at the Ukrainians from Russian territory. The Ukrainians were not shooting back on those batteries on Russian territory because they don't want to provoke a full Russian invasion. But if we move in further on to Mariupol, Donbass, and further to Crimea, we'll get into a place where we'll have to either use air force or move our batteries already on Ukrainian territory, and they'll be in a position to hit back.
Well,
so that's that's an escalation, a kind of final step of escalation that the Kremlin is right now apparently hesitant to make.
But on Sunday,
you can't really march in Crimea if you don't really try to pretend that Russian troops are not fighting there at all.
Well, just in closing,
and the rebels per se, without the Russian regular forces at their core are not really capable of such decisive offensive.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Pavel Felkenhauer, apparently on Sunday, Russian television did show that there were 10 Russian paratroopers that were returned home in exchange for 63 captured Ukrainian soldiers. So they're at least admitting something is going on in a military sense in Ukraine.
That capture was admitted rather soon. It was announced that they just strayed over the border. But it's clear that the officials are rather wary of telling the population that we're fighting in southern Ukraine, that we're taking casualties, though these 10 people that were taken prisoner, yes, they were acknowledged, and now they were exchanged.
So they're back over the border. They just strayed over the border.
Well, actually, they moved with they were armed, and they moved further on, and there was a military clash when they were taken prisoner.
Sure.
So they were part of a larger task force that was actually attacking to encircle a Ukrainian attack force that was attempting to to encircle Donetsk,
the
biggest city in the area.
The Dutch authorities will be releasing their preliminary report on the shootdown of the Malaysian airliner. And it's as expected, since it was shot down by a Russian missile in the hands of the pro-Russian separatists. And my understanding was that it actually was fired by a group of Russian soldiers from the Sakhalin in the Pacific. So if that report is damning and Putin is held responsible, what difference would it make?
Well, I don't think it's going to be that damning. The forensic evidence that could be gathered can only show that there was a missile. It won't show who fired it. So Russia can continue to go into denial. I mean, forensically, it can't prove there's no signature mark on the shrapnel that hit the plane. You can only say that it was hit by shrapnel and maybe establish the type of missile. And actually, this was most likely one missile launcher, and you would need only one well-trained officer to operate it. And there are a crew of three more, which can be any. In normal Russian conditions, these would be conscript soldiers, and one officer professional, and that's enough. Of course, it could maybe from Sakhalin or maybe from other kind of place of Russia. I don't think right now there is any convincing evidence from where he was. Apparently, it was Russian trained, though some Ukrainian sources say it could be Ukrainian. Which had knowledge of this book system.
Sure.
And actually, to show from where the missile was fired, the commission that's investigating the black boxes and the forensic evidence of the on the spot and on the debris and on the bodies, it can't figure that out. That's impossible. So I don't think this report is going to be that damning for Russia, and that the denial will continue.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here this morning from Moscow, Dr. Pavel Felkenhauer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Pavel Felkenhauer, who's a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and from 1994 to 2005, he published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Dr. Felkenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. His regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications, and he joined us from Moscow. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back speaking with Laurie Wallach, the founder and director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Laurie Wallach, who's the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. She's an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policies such as NAFTA, the WTO, CAFTA, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She works closely with Congress, scholars, and activists in the U.S. and developing countries to foster the growing debate about the implications of different models of globalization on jobs, offshoring, wages, the environment, public health and food safety, equality and social justice, and democratically accountable governance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laurie Wallach.
Thank you very much.
And Laurie, I've been getting a lot of mail from listeners saying we need to discuss the Trans-Pacific trade to TPP that's under fast track being secretly negotiated. So you're the perfect person to explain why it is important.
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, is an agreement that basically is like the grudge match of NAFTA. It's not really mainly about trade. It would establish a whole new set of rights and powers for multinational corporations and constrain what all of the governments involved can do to protect the environment, secure our privacy, make sure there's safe food, make sure that we have access to affordable medicines, etc. And it's being negotiated in secret. It was started by President Bush. There are now 12 countries involved, the U.S., Japan, our NAFTA partners, Mexico and Canada, plus Malaysia, Vietnam, Singapore, Chile, Peru, its Pacific Rim countries. And the big news, I guess, would be that President Obama recently gave a speech saying he wants the thing done this November at a global summit, a regional summit he'll be attending, in Asia, in China, called the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. That's the middle of November he wants a deal.
But so why is it then that President Obama, who cannot get anything done with Congress, has been given authority by the Congress to negotiate this fast-track authority to negotiate in secret?
Well, that's a very interesting point because actually he hasn't. And that, for anyone who is concerned about what this kind of agreement with the whole Pacific Rim would mean for their jobs, for their children's futures, for access to medicine here and abroad, access to the internet. I mean, there is nothing that is not implicated by this Trojan horse called a trade agreement, which isn't. For folks who are concerned, making sure the president isn't given the special fast-track trade authority is our way to make sure we don't get stuck with TPP. Now, for folks who want to know more about what TPP means to their day-to-day lives, check out the website exposethetpp.org, exposethetpp.org, and then go to whatever issue is of special concern to you, climate, food safety, chemicals, energy, and you can see analysis because some of the texts have now leaked, and in some of the countries, the negotiators are actually getting worried about what the U.S. agenda would mean for their own country. So there's a certain amount of information. Now, as far as this fast-track business, right now, so far, largely because of 18 months of excellent activism by folks across our country, President Obama doesn't have the fast-track authority. And the way the deal works here is that the founders of our country actually gave Congress exclusive authority in the Constitution over trade. It all came out of the Boston Tea Party. We're a country that was hatched out of a trade war. So they didn't want any more kings, like old King George, just deciding unilaterally to put up tariffs in those days on tea. So Congress has authority over trade. It's one of the strongest checks and balances in our Constitution, because the president, of course, has the right to negotiate it for all of us with foreign countries. But the president can't negotiate a trade agreement without authority from Congress. So that's where all of us, member by member of Congress, can basically make sure that President Obama, and any future president, by the way, is given strict instructions of no more NAFTA-type job-killing, environment-destroying trade agreements. And that's where we can make a difference and avoid the TPP.
And again, I'm speaking with Lori Wallach, who's the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. She's an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policies such as NAFTA, the WTO, CAFTA, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She also works closely with Congress, scholars, and activists in the U.S. and in developing countries to foster the growing debate about the implications of different models of globalization on jobs, offshoring wages, the environment, public health, and food safety, equality, and social justice, and democratically accountable governance. So far, in terms of activism, over 3 million people here in the United States have signed a petition to stop Fast Track, and 65,000 people protested the TPP in Mexico, and more than 1.8 million in Australia signed a petition calling on the text of the secret negotiations to be made public. Of course, that is one-tenth of the population of Australia. And my understanding is that the Obama administration and Congress are trying to get this agreement done and signed around the G20 summit, which is being held in Sydney, Australia, on November the 15th and 16th. Is that your understanding, too? You mentioned that it would be the APEC conference in China.
Well, there's a dangerous little gap in between the APEC conference and the G20. There is a sort of two-day window in there in the middle of November where folks suspect there will be a special TPP heads of state meeting held someplace, maybe Singapore, between China and Australia. And President Obama is not coming home during that period. And, Ian, everything's coming to a head around that time. So for folks who care about this, now is our window, because already a special lame duck session of Congress where the retired and the fired get to come back for votes after the election has been announced for literally starting that same week. So to some degree, we think what President Obama's strategy is, because he announced when New Zealand's prime minister was in Washington in May, he made a surprise announcement that by the time of the APEC summit, they wanted to have a deal to announce. And since then, we've seen a lot of extra negotiations on TPP. Now, Congress, to date, in a really interesting transpartisan coalition of Democrats who are worried about the offshoring and the unsafe imports and the environmental disaster, and Republicans who think either Fast Track's unconstitutional or don't want to give Obama any more power to mix, those guys all together and gals have added up to a majority against more of the old Fast Track. So Obama's strategy seems to be to try and get a deal announced at one of those summits, when he's there with all the other TPP heads of state, get it out of the hands of the negotiators and just have all the heads of state together make a deal, and then to be able to use that to put basically a bum rush on Congress to delegate away their constitutional trade authority to give them this fast track. Now, what fast track does is it basically says Congress doesn't get to vote before the agreement gets signed. And when they finally do get to vote, it's yes or no on the whole deal. The vote has to happen 90 days after it's submitted, no amendments, and limited debate. Now, of course, we'd all fantasize about something like that procedure for, like, a climate bill. Never happens. Not for any other kind of treaty, either. Not for peace treaty, nuclear treaty, nothing. Just historically, since Nixon, 15 times, that lunatic procedure, Fast Track, has been used to ram through trade agreements like NAFTA and WTO. We've had hundreds of real trade agreements that aren't, you know, these corporate power agreements without Fast Track. So there's going to be a big push on Fast Track in the lame duck session. And folks who care about this need to make sure, particularly their representative, it's going to be a fight in the House, their representative is ready to say no. It's going to be a lot of pressure if they announce a TPP deal to try and bum-rush Congress to vote for Fast Track. If we can make sure there's no Fast Track, you're spot on as far as the growing protests, as well as everything you mentioned. There were 5 million signatures in the petition in Japan that was gathered in the course of 3 weeks against TPP. In Malaysia, the government is quite divided about not the trade part, which is a small part, 5 of the 20 chapters of TPP about trade. The government in Malaysia is very worried about the other parts, the corporate tribunals, the so-called investor-state system that allows corporations to go around our courts and demand compensation from us taxpayers if they don't like our domestic regulatory policies or the rules that would jack up medicine prices with bigger, longer patent durations. Those are the kind of issues, financial deregulation that slipped in there. Those are the issues that a lot of countries are still pretty concerned about. So if we can make sure there's no fast track and our counterparts in the other countries can continue the excellent work they're doing, we can make sure we don't have a corporate rights agreement for the Pacific. Maybe down the road we can have a real trade agreement. That could work out. But we have to make sure we do our part in the U.S. so there's no TPP. And there's going to be a huge push to sign it in November.
Well, Lori Wallach, it sort of didn't make any sense to me that anything would be done in terms of TPP in China, because if you look at the countries involved, it's everybody but China. And it's clearly the Chinese must see this TPP as a sort of ganging up on them, surely. I mean, what's the point of excluding China since it's the fastest growing economy on the planet?
The notion behind it in the logic of the corporations that were pushing TPP is that the U.S. and like-minded countries would set a whole range of rules, not so much about trade, but what you can do for financial regulation, what you can do for financial regulation, what kind of climate policies you can have, what kind of privacy and internet policies you could have. Because the trick to TPP is a clause that says each signatory country shall ensure all of its domestic laws, regulations, and procedures meet the attached agreements. And if you don't change all your domestic laws, you have trade sanctions, so you have to pay cash damages. So it's enforceable corporate rule. And the idea for all these big companies that were pushing it, and sadly, the Obama administration's in on this, Bush started it, but they jumped right in support, was they would basically write these rules and somehow they would make China have to meet our kind of rules if they wanted to be part of this party. Now, China's looked at this from a distance and sort of laughed. It's a little bit like saying, I will strip off my clothes, run outside naked, and freeze my entire country, ruin my health care, mess up my environment, and ruin my wages. And then I will look at the country that's still fully clothed inside and say, ha, ha, ha. You can't join us unless you strip naked, too. Ha ha, come on out. I mean, the Chinese have just kind of laughed at this idea. But that, Ian, is the logic. The logic is we will impose the rules, and China will be so eager to jump into this dreadful model that they will have to sign up. That's the logic.
But in terms of the specter of Smoot-Hawley, the idea that protesters are trying to destroy free trade and global trade, and you're just back from Europe, and Germany's got one of the most successful economies, which is certainly trade-driven. I guess the point here is that there's a huge difference between free trade and the corporatization of the international economy.
That's right. So let's look at TPP just specifically. It's a genius strategy for the corporations. They've taken a brand that's very popular, free trade, and they've taken words like trade expansion, exports, those are all positive words, and they've attached that to a totally different agenda. And their agenda, for instance, in TPP, of all those chapters in TPP, very few of them have to do with trade. So their five chapters are really about things like cutting tariffs or border standards, customs, etc. All the other rules are basically like some kind of slow-motion coup d'etat, some kind of Trojan horse stunt, where the rules are called non-tariff standards. That's, again, branding. What they literally are is imposing a set of non-trade policies, effectively like diplomatically legislating, and rewriting the policies that affect their day-to-day lives that have nothing to do with trade. And in a lot of instances, because these negotiations are secret, and in the past this fast-track procedure has basically functioned like some legislative luge run to run right over Congress, there have been imposition of policies that explicitly failed in Congress via a trade agreement, and that's what's going on right now. So just for instance, we all saw the huge fight over health care in the U.S., and there's some rules, including the right for Medicare and Medicaid, to use what are called formularies. Formularies are sort of bargaining units so that the states can have a better price from the big pharmaceutical companies when they purchase medicines for Medicare and Medicaid. Well, there was a huge fight about whether that would be in the bill. It wasn't a great version of the bill, but it was an improvement relative to what was there before to help bring down med prices. In TPP, the U.S. negotiators are pushing to allow the pharmaceutical companies to challenge all of those decisions that Obamacare finally put into place to try and save money for us consumers. Or we just did the Food Safety Modernization Act. We finally have some decent import inspection. The TPP would require us, if it goes into effect as written, there's a whole chapter on food standards, unrelated to trade, would require us to accept imports that explicitly don't meet our new standards, revised literally 2 years ago with this much-trumpeted improvement in food safety standards. Or we're having a big debate in the United States about energy efficiency and climate policies. The TPP has a provision that would forbid us from limiting the export of liquid natural gas to any country that would be in the TPP. So it would basically increase fracking, increase carbon-based fuels, contrary ostensibly to the debates of what the Obama administration is pushing right now. Issue after issue, financial reform, we just re-regulated finance. The chapter on financial services in the TPP, again, totally unrelated to trade, would strictly constrain a lot of the very policies we've just put into place and would even forbid the use of things like capital controls, which the IMF, hardly a bastion of liberal thinking, is now requiring countries to use to avoid financial bubbles, speculation, and crises. So if you think of this so-called trade agreement as a delivery mechanism, as a really clever branding stunt, on the side, in a little bucket, is some real trade stuff. There is some real trade stuff. I have no problem with that part of the agreement. But it's like an afterthought. It's a Dixie cup in an ocean. And the ocean is all of this sneaky stuff that would either establish new corporate rights. I mean, you know, this is a free trade agreement by brand name. They're new monopoly rights, rent-seeking behavior for our economist friends who are listening to patent extensions. So there's a whole chapter on intellectual property extending the monopoly in a free trade agreement for patents on medicines to raise up prices, extending copyrights even longer so textbooks would cost more, for instance, having rules that would, in the name of trademark, make it harder to have, say, plain packaging policies for cigarettes for public health. All this stuff has nothing to do with trade, but if we didn't change our domestic laws to meet those rules, that would be imposed in TPP and all the other countries too, we'd face permanent trade sanctions. That's what's at stake. It's nothing to do with Smoot-Hawley. It's everything to do with a sneak attack, really.
Well,
democratic undermining.
Well, Lori Wallach, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Lori Wallach, who's the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. She's an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policies such as NAFTA, the WTO, CAFTA, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She works closely with Congress, scholars, and activists in the U.S. and developing countries to foster the growing debate about the implications of different models of globalization on jobs, offshoring, wages, the environment, public health, and food safety, equality and social justice, and democratically accountable governance. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back on this Labor Day weekend talking about the state of working America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sylvia Allegretto, who's a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sylvia Allegretto.
Good to speak with you again, Ian.
And Sylvia, the according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the median salary for a male worker in 1969 was $35,567 in 2012 dollars, and today it is $33,904. So that means that for 44 years, most Americans have been caught in a great stagnation while the wages of the top 10% have continued to climb. Do you think that this is widely understood, that 90% of us have been treading water, in fact, going backwards slightly from $35,567 in 1969 to $33,904 today?
Well, I think people are finally understanding these long-term trends, especially coming out of the Great Recession. The Economic Policy Institute just wrote a report showing that the wages in 2014 have been flat. That's after 5.5 years of economic recovery. 5.5 years of economic recovery. But as you pointed out, it's much worse than that. It's a 40-year trend where it's not just low-wage workers who are falling behind. It's even the typical workers who aren't getting ahead. And this is quite incredible, given over a 40-year period of time, the economic pie, right, economic growth has more than doubled. And the U.S. workers, some of the most productive workers in the world, productivity has been soaring, yet the typical worker is not doing much better and quite likely doing worse than their counterparts were 30 or 40 years ago. And I think that's why you see a lot more support these days for issues such as and policies such as raising the minimum wage. Because we do know, again, as you pointed out, that all the additional growth and all the additional income in our economy, or at least the lion's share of it, is going to already extremely wealthy people.
So how does this translate, though, into politics? You know, the president, of course, has tried to raise the minimum wage, and he's done it through executive order for federal employees or mm-hmm. contractors doing business with the government. But that, of course, is limited by this intransigent do-nothing Congress that he basically can't get anything done with. So he's going to be over this Labor Day weekend on Labor Day in Wisconsin for the annual Labor Fest, where he'll be standing on a platform with Democrat Mary Burke, who's deadlocked in a close race for governor with Scott Walker, the controversial Republican governor of Wisconsin, and who, of course, had that big fight when he basically took away the rights of public employees in the state. So that in itself is pretty political, is it? So give me a sense between the reality of what we just talked about, how people's wages have been stagnant for over 40 years, and where is the political fight at the moment?
I think there's a couple really important issues here. One is that, like I just mentioned, the minimum wage polls extremely high among voters. You know, it's over, I believe, 80% for Democratic voters, and it's over a majority even for Republican voters. So the question is, once our representatives get to Washington, why don't they represent the interests of the voters, which is to raise the minimum wage? And I think it's a microcosm of what's going on in Washington, D.C., and that's, you know, where politics intersects with money and lobbyists. And that's the reason it doesn't get done, even though, again, this is an issue that polls very high among voters. And I think with Scott Walker, for instance, the way he attacked public sector workers and their unions, on Labor Day, you know, we would be remiss not to talk about the fact that one of the issues and problems that we have is that we need stronger unions. We need right to organize. Those who want to join a union should be able to very efficiently and easily. And because I believe that when you ask about where all these issues intersect with politics, it's all politics. The fact that we don't have full employment policies, that's a political decision. The fact that we have globalization on the level that we have is a political decision. These free trade agreements, those are political decisions. So when we talk about workers falling further and further behind over a 30 or 40 year period, you can't talk about that without talking about the political decisions that helped make this happen. The inequality that we're seeing today was driven purposely by these political decisions, by political elites and the wealthy. And of course, all of those decisions over 30, 40 years have made the wealthy much wealthier at the expense of everyone else.
Sylvia, there's a new Gallup poll out that has some conflicting data. A slight majority of Americans, that's 53%, say they support unions. But 71% say they support right-to-work laws, which, of course, make it illegal to require employers in any organized workplace to join a union. And that's obviously solidly true in the South. And so it gets to the idea that unions have a real problem convincing the American workers that they just aren't out there to suck dollars out of their paycheck for union dues, which, of course, is how the Chamber of Commerce and Republicans try to portray them. So is this a problem, or is this the main problem, is just explaining the difference between what unions are about and why they benefit workers and benefit the broad economy and the country itself? Because, you know, we were a social democracy between 1944 and about 1977.
Right.
And, you know, once you get rid of unions, the standard of living goes down for the majority of Americans.
Yeah, I think you've touched on a couple issues here. One is that the unions, you know, have to do a better job. They have to do a better job at connecting everything we're talking about here and how unions play a large role in that. But again, the decline of unions isn't just because folks don't want unions, because a lot of folks do, but it's been purposeful policy that has weakened unions. And that just didn't happen. Again, it came from the folks that you mentioned, the Chamber of Commerce, the Republicans, the wealthy elite business interests. They've spent a lot of money portraying unions as bad and portraying unions as not being able to help American workers and portraying unions as greedy. When again, as you know very well know, the wealth are getting wealthier, getting much wealthier. Corporations are paying less in taxes, walking away with the largest share of national income on record, and that again is at the cost of working folks getting ahead. And so they've spent a lot of money influencing the beliefs that are now held in the U.S. about unions and labor unions and how they can help workers. It's just simply a fact. And when we go back through history, that nothing is going to get us out of this mess that doesn't include some type of organized labor groups, unions, other types of groups that have sprouted up, like the R Walmarts of the world that are different than traditional unions. Whatever it may be, we need collective action, because workers know, at least a large swath of workers now realize, post-Great Recession, that they have no power. And unemployment remains extremely high, even again, 5 years after we've been in economic recovery. This recovery has not reached most of Americans, especially in terms of wages, like you brought up. And so, we do have, these competing interests, and the ones that are trying to lay out the groundwork about how unions are bad for workers and unions won't help workers are spending a tremendous amount of money doing so. And what's really quite ironic is those are the same folks that make sure that workers never get ahead.
Well, it seems in many ways that this, maybe it's about framing here. Maybe we need George Lakoff, your colleague there at Berkeley,
yeah.
Because,
right.
For example, in the abortion debate, Those that are against abortion choose the phrase pro-life, which of course sounds very, very lofty. Whereas the other side has their motto, if for the want of a better way to describe it, is pro-choice, which seems frivolous by
right.
comparison.
Mm-hmm.
So, and when you have right to work, it just sounds like freedom. You know, you have a choice. You know, whereas unions have been labeled with the idea that they're coercive, when in fact they raise, you know, the standard of living of their members. And again, we have an example from 47 to 77.
Right.
You know, that was the American dream, particularly under President Eisenhower, who, when the wealthy paid 92% income tax. So there are, as you pointed out earlier, there are political reasons why inequality has happened, and they are largely to do with how Congress has basically being taken over by the wealthy.
Yeah, and that's right. And again, like it does have to do with messaging. Right to work is one of those tricks that they use to make it seem like it is a pro-worker issue. And you know, this has happened over and over again. And they're the same folks that tell you, you know, we're rich. The very rich people would have you believe they're rich because they just work harder. And if you don't believe that, it's just the hand, the invisible hand of the free market that we can't interfere with. And that's simply all not true. There is no free market that comes down from on high from, you know, being channeled by Ayn Rand or someone. The market is the market that we make it to be. It's always within cultural norms. It's always within rules and regulations. But the people now that are dictating those rules and regulations and tax rates and minimum wages and such are the wealthy elites. And so it's no surprise that over the last 30 or 40 years, they have just gotten so much more wealthy, as most of the rules and regulations now benefit capital over labor, which is already inherent in a capitalist system. But what we had in the period where you're talking about, post-World War II and into the mid-70s, was at least part of, you know, the pendulum started swinging at least somewhat towards giving labor and everyday workers and their families some power. And that meant that, you know, workers shared more broadly in the prosperity of the nation. And that's just simply no longer the case anymore, as the pendulum has swung back to power of capital way over labor. And without full employment policies, without strong unions, workers are just not able on their own to get ahead and to, you know, walk into their boss's office and say, hey, I need a raise. It just simply doesn't happen on your own without collective action or without strong governmental policies.
Well, Sylvia Legretta, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Sylvia Allegretta, who's a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.